Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, August 11th, 2026. And here are today's news briefs. Perseid meteor shower arrives in Northern Hemisphere. The Perseid meteor shower is expected to streak across the Northern Hemisphere sky Tuesday and Wednesday nights. Considered among the best meteor showers of the year, it can rain down 50 to 100 meters per hour if the sky is dark enough. The shower results from Earth's annual passage through leftover debris from Comet Swift-Tuttle every summer. The debris burns up as it enters our atmosphere, creating the light we call meteors. The shower is called Perseids because it looks like it's coming from the Perseus constellation. The best way to view the meteor shower is away from city lights between 11 p.m. and sunrise. 4:09 p.m. ET staff. Russia's Supreme Court bans anti-war party from election. About a dozen parties are registered to take part in Russia's September polls for the 450-seat state Duma, including a spectrum of left, liberal, and right-wing nationalist parties that oppose the ruling United Russia Party. But only the liberal Yabloko Party is explicitly against the war in Ukraine, a crucial issue. As hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Moscow courthouse on Monday, Russia's Supreme Court struck that option from the ballot by barring the party, which has taken part in every Russian federal election since 1991, from running in this one. 1:21 p.m. ET staff. Lebanon's parliament moved to abolish capital punishment. A majority of Lebanon's 128-member parliament voted Tuesday to ban the death penalty and replace it with life imprisonment and hard labor. Justice Minister Adel Nassar called it a historic step, pending presidential approval. Lebanon is set to become the 114th nation to abolish the death penalty, according to Amnesty International. 54 countries retain the practice, including the United States. The parliamentary bloc of Hezbollah did not support the ban. The last time Lebanon carried out an execution was 2004. 11:58 a.m. ET staff. The Department of Justice is monitoring today's primary election in Minnesota. 20 members of its Civil Rights Division, in partnership with federal prosecutors, are monitoring polling sites in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, which include the Minneapolis-St. Paul Metroplex. The monitors will be working to ensure transparency, ballot security, and compliance with federal law, the agency said in a press release. Harmeet Dhillon, head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division, described Minnesota as the next stop on the agency's nationwide effort to ensure free and fair elections. The agency monitored federal elections in the state in the 2020, 2022, and 2024 elections. 11:16 a.m., ET staff. Key Amazon cases reach Brazil's Supreme Court. Brazil's Supreme Court is set to decide cases that could reshape protections for the Amazon rainforest and indigenous communities. These cases involve indigenous land rights, environmental safeguards, and infrastructure projects. Congress approved measures that environmentalists say violate constitutional rights, but President Lula vetoed some. Lawmakers overrode these objections, sending disputes to the Supreme Court. Environmental advocates see the court as a defense against weakening protections. Despite reducing deforestation, Lula's administration struggles against a conservative Congress aligned with agribusiness. The Supreme Court's decisions could significantly impact Brazil's environmental and indigenous policies. 9:24 a.m. E.T., Associated Press. Syria's toppled president sentenced to death in absentia. The Syrian court issued a death sentence in absentia to ousted President Bashar al-Assad after convicting him of murder, torture, arbitrary detention, and crimes against humanity. Mr. Assad has been sheltering in Moscow since his regime collapsed in December 2024. Other former officials also received death sentences. They include Mr. Assad's cousin, Atef Najib, and brother, Maher al-Assad. The former commander of the elite 4th Division, which played a central role in the violent crackdown on opposition areas during the 2011 protests and ensuing civil war. 8:26 a.m. ET staff. Colombia begins earthquake recovery with help from the region. President Abelardo de la Espriella declared an emergency following a 7.4 magnitude earthquake on Monday. The quake hit the remote Chocó region, one of the poorest and most neglected parts of Colombia, often beset by warring armed groups. Governments across Latin America and elsewhere have offered to help. The U.S. State Department announced it would provide $15.5 million for emergency shelter, food, and other aid. The earthquake presents the first major test for Mr. de la Espriella, who was sworn in on Friday. He visited Chocó's capital, Quibdó, on Monday night to mobilize the entire military and police apparatus to respond, deploying engineers, rescue workers, and search dogs. Chocó will never again be the land of the forgotten, he said. 7:21 a.m. ET, Associated Press. And from the Asia Pacific, our first article is Internet Slowdown and Drones in the Strait. Taiwan Preps for Potential China Conflict by Ann Scott Tyson, staff writer. Taiwan throttled its own internet during annual defense exercises this week, readying its population for a possible future attack by China. The half-hour drill on Monday in the central city of Taichung, to be repeated Thursday in northern Taiwan and in Taipei, blocked millions of people from using mobile phone streaming and other high-data phone functions, while the government tested backup communication systems. Air raid sirens sounded as people took shelter in underground parking lots, shops, and basements. The unprecedented test marks a new initiative in Taiwan's efforts to leapfrog ahead in its defensive tactics against China, a much stronger, better-resourced potential adversary. Taiwan is finding new ways to ready itself for asymmetric conflict with China. Its 2026 defense drills include disabling the internet to test civil resilience and practicing drone warfare strategies inspired by Ukraine. Beijing claims the self-governing island of Taiwan as its territory and has vowed to annex it by force if necessary. Taiwan's government asserts the island's de facto sovereignty, and the Taiwanese public overwhelmingly prefers to maintain the status quo of autonomy from China. As China increases pressure in Taiwan, the government is expanding its annual civilian and military defense drills, integrating the exercises for the first time this year. This week's mobile network slowdown is part of a whole-of-society defense effort that aims to prepare everyone from civilians and local businesses to government and military officials for a potential conflict. Communications are an important lifeline of national resilience, Premier Cho Chung-tai said last month, in preparation for the exercise. The goal is to test extreme scenarios and verify the government's response capability when communications are limited, he said. On the military front, Taiwan is focused on advancing its drone capabilities. This year's War Games, which run through August 14th and are the largest ever held on the island, involve drone reconnaissance drills that will help Taiwan track and eliminate advancing Chinese forces in the Taiwan Strait. The exercise underscores how Taiwan's leadership is drawing lessons from other war zones. Looking at the Russia-Ukraine war, the Israel-Hamas conflict, and even the current U.S.-Iran war, drones are the most important weapons in the battlefield, said Taiwan President Lai Ching-te during a recent visit to the country's Drone Research Institute in Taichung. They are the representative weapon of asymmetric combat power. Taiwan's army commanders say that Ukraine, in particular, demonstrates how decisive drone warfare can be, assuming their operators are properly trained. Just as soldiers must learn to fire a pistol accurately, drone operators must have proficiency and precision to be effective, said General Liu Kunxiu while overseeing training this past June. In another related article to this article, we have, in Iran's blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, Beijing sees lessons for Taiwan, by Ann Scott Tyson, staff writer. As the world reels from the economic toll of Iran's blockage of the Strait of Hormuz, concern is rising over China's potential cutoff of another critical waterway, the Taiwan Strait, a narrow 110-mile-long channel between Taiwan and mainland China, is a lifeline not just for Taiwan, but for Asia and the rest of the world. One-fifth of the world's maritime trade flows through the Taiwan Strait, compared with about 8% through the Strait of Hormuz, according to research by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank. In its quest to unite the self-governing island of Taiwan with mainland China, Beijing has considered and practiced a blockade of the Taiwan Strait, a critical waterway on which global trade relies. Is the world prepared? Yet China has considered and recently practiced a military blockade of Taiwan as part of its long-term goal of taking over the self-governing island, which would include restricting access to the strait. Such a blockade, if it lasted a year, could slash world gross domestic product by more than 5%, a February report by Bloomberg Economics found. Beijing is closely watching how the Iranian regime has wielded its leverage over the Strait of Hormuz, while Chinese leader Xi Jinping says he wants reopened. The Strait of Hormuz should maintain normal passage, Mr. Xi told Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in a phone call last week. Iran's ability to withstand tremendous pressure to open the Strait of Hormuz underscores how much power China could gain by seizing control of Taiwan and the Taiwan Strait, a more significant waterway. Whereas the Strait of Hormuz is a transit route primarily for crude oil, channeling 20% of global oil consumption before the Iran war, one of the most important commodities exported from Taiwan is advanced semiconductor chips. The island produces more than 90% of the global supply of the most sophisticated chips, which are vital to industries ranging from artificial intelligence to smartphones. Even a temporary disruption of the flow of chips, much like Middle East oil shipments in the Strait of Hormuz, would impact production and prices of goods around the world. Yet, in recent years, China has ramped up actions to temporarily restrict traffic on the strait and has rehearsed a military blockade of Taiwan as part of a pressure campaign to bring the island under Beijing's control. Mr. Xi has stressed that China's reunification with Taiwan, which Beijing considers a renegade province, is inevitable. Chinese Communist government has never ruled Taiwan, but claims the island of 23 million people as its territory and has vowed to take it over by force if necessary. No matter how the international landscape or the situation in the Taiwan Strait may evolve, Mr. Xi told a visiting pro-Beijing politician from Taiwan last month, the great tide of compatriots on both sides of the strait coming together will not change. This is the verdict of history. To that end, Beijing is practicing a spectrum of potential moves against Taiwan, ranging from bombardment and invasion to a blockade or quarantine, in which China would seize control over what comes and goes from the island. All these options would restrict traffic through the Taiwan Strait to some degree, as have their practice drills. In December, the People's Liberation Army waged war games called Justice Mission 2025 to encircle the island. Dozens of Chinese warplanes and ships staged live-fire drills and simulated cutting off the island and its ports. The drills, the largest such exercise to date, forced dozens of flight cancellations and risked disrupting maritime activities in the strait. China has already shut down flows from Taiwan for periods of time, says Eric Freeman, a Hoover Institution fellow at Stanford University and author of Defending Taiwan, A Strategy to Prevent War with China. It's not a question of whether or when Xi Jinping chooses to enter the gray zone, he says, using gray to describe coercive actions that fall short of war. We are already in the gray. This spring, Beijing abruptly and without explanation announced a huge airspace restriction zone located about 250 miles northeast of the island in the East China Sea and Yellow Sea to last from late March till early May. During this 40-day period, aircraft can't travel there without coordination with China's aviation authorities. Using such tactics, China can slowly tighten its grip on Taiwan or even assert administrative control overnight, says Dr. Freeman. To be sure, China's control of trade in and around Taiwan could backfire by slowing the global economy and lowering countries' demand for Chinese exports. A quarantine, blockade, or imposition of a customs territory around Taiwan would disrupt the maritime shipping and trading system that China itself relies heavily upon. The U.S. government recently assessed that Beijing does not plan to attack Taiwan in 2027, and most experts agree that China would prefer to assert its sovereignty over the island without triggering a war. Nevertheless, like Tehran, Beijing may calculate that it's better positioned to withstand some economic pain than the United States and its allies. Under Mr. Xi, who has prioritized national security, China has been stockpiling food, energy, key technology, and other resources to sustain the country, even if it is cut off from the seaborne trade. In Taiwan, meanwhile, concern is rising over Beijing's aggression in the strait, making ordinary citizens more wary of China. From the windy fishing port of Chuwei in Taiwan's northwest coast, fishmonger Wang Chiu-Che can see a steady stream of international cargo ships and fishing vessels passing the Taiwan Strait. For the past 30 years, Ms. Wang has sold fresh catches of local seafood at the nearby market, and she depends on the hauls of Taiwan's fishing fleets. She worries what would happen if China were to take control of the waterway. If you blockade Taiwan, what will happen to our lives? She says, it's not right. Our next article is from Europe. In Ukraine, a city waits to rebuild a symbol of resistance, by Howard LaFranchi, staff writer. Irpin, Ukraine. Within a year of being pummeled by Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, Irpin's prestigious state tax university had been mostly repaired, but not its main building, the symbol of an institution that for decades has prepared many of Ukraine's top public finance officials and ministers sat bomb-blasted and unusable. University and city leaders had decided that the building's reconstruction was a special case, requiring special treatment. They wanted a rebuild that would serve as an example for the country's broader national reconstruction, incorporating elements of sustainable and inclusive construction they hoped would exemplify an advancing and more democratic Ukraine. The Ukrainian city of Irpin was one of the first places to be attacked during Russia's full-scale invasion. Now, the rebuilding of its prestigious university is being seen as an example for the country's national reconstruction. But that kind of reconstruction project would take more time and more money, something the national government could not even consider with the war monopolizing resources. There can be two approaches in a case like ours. There is the quick rebuilding, like replacing blasted windows, which we did with some buildings, says Dmytro Serebryansky, rector of the State Tax University, known widely as STU, that sits northwest of Kyiv. But then there is strategic rebuilding. University leadership decided we wanted not just a rebuilding of the old structure, but something symbolizing a new future, first for our university, he adds. But how to even start such a broader rebuild project with the war continuing and resources required for that effort? Enter Build Forward Ukraine. Half a world away in San Francisco, an organization bringing together Ukrainians, Americans, and others interested in promoting elements of sustainability, inclusivity, and democracy in Ukraine's vast rebuilding effort. We're looking for what could be a demonstration project for their vision. The search to lead a collaboration between Build Forward Ukraine and STU that aims to culminate in the rebuilt and reimagined main building. Moreover, cooperation blossomed when both sides realized they were engaging with partners who shared a vision for the qualities and values that should underpin Ukraine's reconstruction. The amazing thing was our realization that we all wanted this project to go beyond rebuilding a university building to advancing the values of Ukrainians that they want for their national reconstruction and future, says Margie O'Driscoll, CEO of Build Forward Ukraine. We realized this when we heard from Ukrainians themselves that rebuilding institutions like STU also had to serve the purpose of forming new leaders to implement the road to democracy and European Union accession. Build Forward Ukraine's inspiration to foster reconstruction, even with war raging, came from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, says Ms. O'Driscoll. She recalls that just 6 weeks into the full-scale invasion, Mr. Zelensky was urging the nation to start rebuilding. We were struck by the leader talking about defense and rebuilding at the same time. It inspired us to think there could be already a role for us. The Build Forward Ukraine team was also aware of Irpin and the special role the city had played in the dark early days, repelling the Russian ground offensive aimed at taking Kyiv, 14 miles south. They would learn later that Irpin's university had held the line between the 30% of the city that fell under Russian occupation and the 70% that remained free. The first victory in the Kyiv region was in Irpin, and our university played an important role in halting the Russian advance and saving Kyiv, said Oleksandr Markishin, who was Irpin's mayor in 2022. I recall seeing the main building burning, he adds, so I feel strongly about rebuilding it as a symbol of free Ukraine standing firm on the Western values we aspire to. Once the Russian troops retreated, Mr. Markishin oversaw the quick type of reconstruction of Irpin's damaged and destroyed residential buildings. But he would later meet with Build Forward Ukraine representatives and Dr. Serebryansky to discuss the rector's vision of the strategic rebuild at the university. Ms. Driscoll and several others from her organization visited Ukraine in the summer of 2023, a tour that included Irpin, and then invited a group of Ukrainians, including Dr. Serebryansky, to San Francisco. There they met with experts in such areas as sustainable building practices and efficient energy systems from Berkeley, Stanford, and other Bay Area universities. The experts shared what worked and not in other international reconstruction projects, including Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. Once Build Forward Ukraine decided on the Irpin University main building as its demonstration project, it was Dr. Sarah Bryansky who insisted that the building's redesign plan be selected from among entries in an international competition and not just awarded behind closed doors to a hand-picked design group. It was Dimitro who remarked to us that opening up the selection of architects and making it part of a public process of reconstruction would really change the way buildings were built in Ukraine. Notes Ms. O'Driscoll, project planners realized transparency would be an important element in a country battling a long heritage of corruption. They also realized that they were now part of not just one building's reconstruction, but a process where following and instilling democratic practices and acknowledging cultural sensitivities was going to be just as important as the final product. Earlier this year, an international jury of architects and construction experts chose the design entry from Canadian company Stantec out of 49 entries from 18 countries for the STU project. Then in April, the Build Forward Ukraine team brought together representatives of Stantec and Ukrainians in a London conference that included visits to the area's great universities. Project planners estimate it will still be at least 3 years before the STU main building reopens because of the time it will take to finalize the design, line up financing, and carry out the construction. Both the World Bank and European Bank of Reconstruction and Development have expressed interest in participating in the project. Meanwhile, the process by which Irpin's University joins in the larger project of rebuilding Ukraine will continue, the project's enthusiasts say. Of course, we are anxious to see our beloved main building open and serving our university and our community once again, says Dr. Sarah Bryansky. But the great universities we visited, including Oxford and Cambridge, were not built quickly. We understand this, he adds, that the steps we are taking to reach that final goal are an important part of the building the new Ukraine we all want. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. This is on the economy. Who wins when Congress calls the plays in college sports? By Ken Macon, cultural commentator. Marcus Littmore, a former elite running back from the University of South Carolina, has a unique understanding of the trappings of fame within the realm of college athletics. He uses a single word, terrified, to describe his concerns for current players, whom he considers the little brothers. The college sports landscape has changed in the nearly 15 years since Mr. Lattimore played in South Carolina, and now Congress is weighing in. Currently, legislators are considering the Protect College Sports Act, which inspires to place federal guardrails on what is perceived by many as the Wild West of modern revenue-generating college sports. Through the Protect College Sports Act, lawmakers are weighing in on the new era of revenue-generating college sports. Athletes are wondering who will represent them. At the center of the bipartisan legislation is NIL, short for Name, Image, and Likeness, which corresponds to a student-athlete's ability to use their personal brand to make money. The bill would establish uniform requirements. Presently, rules vary by state, for NIL agreements for college athletes, and provide a limited antitrust exemption for schools and conferences to pool and sell certain college sports media rights. It also allows student athletes one penalty-free transfer through the transfer portal, which lets players change institutions for increased playing time or more money, and has drawn criticism for its overuse. There's a kinship that I share with a high-profile recruit or someone playing college football at a high level because I've sat in their shoes, says Mr. Lattimore, who went on to play for the San Francisco 49ers. I'm terrified for what there will be if there's no psychological or wellness practice, if they don't have a centering device. The act failed to reach a vote during a pre-recess session in the Senate over the past weekend. It's now slated for September, after the chamber returns from summer break. Mr. Lattimore notes that the current legislation seems confusing to me because of the sport's controversial history when it comes to player compensation. Some college boosters and coaches had long found ways to pay choice recruits or their families. They were paying players before it was legal to pay players, he says. Now that payments are above board and Congress is getting involved, the former running back agrees with those who have suggested college football players have a union to negotiate on their behalf, someone that they can trust has their best interest at heart. Advocates for passing the bill would include President Donald Trump, who held a college sports roundtable in March that was noticeably devoid of current players, and former Alabama football coach Nick Saban, who attended the gathering. Critics have asked whether players' interests are properly represented in the act, if at all. The NAACP, which in May called for a boycott by athletes in southern states where black voting rights were being eroded by redistricting, reiterated its call in the face of the current bill. The Protect College Sports Act is not simply an NIL bill. Public institutions cannot depend upon black athletes to fill their stadiums, secure television contracts, attract donations, and build nationally recognized brands, then claim neutrality when the political rights of those athletes, their families, and their communities are under attack, wrote NAACP President and CEO Derek Johnson. Ezean Ofogbu, an assistant professor in the Educational Leadership Program at Santa Clara University, who studies social justice commitments and initiatives in college athletics, believes previous NCAA stances inform this current legislative push. The NCAA has a long history of looking to Congress and looking at universities as a means of restoring control over college athletics and college athletes and the way that they behave, Mr. Ofegbu says. The NCAA argued against the implementation of Title IX, that is the law barring sex discrimination in schools receiving federal funds, back in the 1970s. Control was taken from the NCAA by the Supreme Court, indirectly, when NIL became legalized. She adds, I see the Protect College Sports Act and any attempt that the NCAA makes to get Congress to intervene as their attempt to restore control. Discussing potential caps to what athletes can earn while coaches face no such limits is also imbalanced. Dr. Ofegbu adds, as evidenced by recent buyouts for coaches that have drawn displeasure from many. Louisiana State University paid a $54 million buyout to former football coach Brian Kelly. LSU will be paying Brian Kelly $800,000 a month until December of 2031. That's almost around $25,000 a day. But you have Congress and the NCAA who are saying, oh, we need a cap on how much the schools can pay to athletes, Dr. Ofegbu says. Athletes can be taught more about brand deals and endorsements to ensure that money flows to them and schools. But that wasn't what universities and the NCAA intended, she says. Even the term student-athlete, which was created in the 1950s by NCAA Executive Director Walter Byers, who sought a way to avoid paying workers' compensation to players, is hotly debated. Dr. Ofegbu also challenges college sports viewers such as herself to be critical consumers. Especially in the American context, sports are inseparable from politics, and this bill is the perfect example, she says. I think sports are a great site for understanding politics related to gender, race, nationalism, everything. So if we can have these conversations about American pastimes, imagine how those conversations might leak into the ways that we think about education and other American social institutions. Bruce Johnson Jr., a former defensive lineman at South Carolina State University and currently a high school defensive line coach in South Carolina, has been on both sides of the proverbial line. Hailing from humble beginnings in Greenwood, South Carolina, his experiences with football have always been centered around doing the impossible, dreams his father put in his head at an early age. While college athletics remain a great meritocracy, he explains, there are pros and cons in the current landscape. NIL is a good thing. It gives players financial stability, and they can take care of their families at a young age, Mr. Johnson says. I'm not against it, but I still feel like it has to be earned, not given. You have players who have come in and are expecting money, but don't live up to expectations. When it comes to making laws, that can be good and bad, he says. One of the bad things is the control over the players. You don't want someone controlling all of your rights, or as they used to say, feeling like you signed your life over. Our next article is How One Massachusetts City Cut Traffic Deaths to Zero, by Cameron Pugh, staff writer. Alessandra Sater avoids driving. She doesn't enjoy it and concedes to not being very good at it. Sater rides her bike to her job as a librarian at Harvard University's Kennedy School and walks everywhere else. That isn't a risky lifestyle for Sater to lead in Somerville. This densely populated Boston suburb has recently been on a streak. It's gone 3 years without a traffic death, making it a prime example of what can go right in road safety. I'm not surprised to see Somerville really stand out as a traffic safety leader, says Lee Shamahom, founder and executive director of the Vision Zero Network, a national nonprofit that works to eliminate traffic deaths. They've had a really consistent and strong leadership in terms of really prioritizing safety over speed. The United States struggles with traffic safety in comparison with the track records of other developed nations. There are some bright spots, such as the city of Somerville, Massachusetts, where use of road safety tools and community engagement has brought success. Although traffic deaths in the United States have declined after surging during the pandemic, American streets remain hazardous. Some 36,640 people died on the roads in 2025, according to government data. That's about 100 people per day, and 12% higher than the country's best year, 2014. The U.S. performs poorly compared with other developed nations, recording 12.2 deaths per 100,000 people in 2023. Only two other surveyed countries fared worse than that year, according to the International Transport Forum. Few places have had more success bucking those trends than Somerville. For roughly a decade, officials in this city of 81,000 people have focused on reducing car speeds, both by lowering limits and improving infrastructure. And it's done so, proponents say, with a commitment to community engagement and working with volunteer residents to flag safety problems. The city's solutions are neither groundbreaking nor flashy, but they've worked, Last year, Somerville reported a 50% decline in car crashes causing serious injury, and crashes overall have decreased every year since 2022. Everything the city has done, transit activists say, can be replicated elsewhere. They're not using some magic toolbox in Somerville, Ms. Shaham says. They are really leaning into and committing to road safety tools that work best. And so many places could be doing that. In 2017, Somerville, following the footsteps of neighboring Boston and Cambridge, committed to Vision Zero, an international road safety initiative, holding that smartly designed infrastructure can prevent all traffic deaths. The idea started in Sweden in 1997 and has since spread around the world. More than 70 other U.S. cities, including Savannah, Georgia, New York, and Portland, Oregon, have made a Vision Zero commitment, according to Vision Zero Network. We, as humans, do not have to accept the status quo that people lose their lives in the street, says Brad Rawson, who has worked in Somerville's chief transportation official for more than a decade. Yet the city was eyeing safer streets even before Vision Zero. In 2006, a Massachusetts Highway Department report found the city had the most accident-prone intersection in the state. In 2016, Somerville lowered speed limits on most roads from 30 miles per hour to 25 miles per hour, taking advantage of a recently passed state law allowing lower speed limits in certain areas. Since then, the city has created more than 500 safety zones where the speed limit is 20 miles per hour, according to a report by Livable Streets. Vision Zero, though, is about more than legal limits. Road infrastructure, proponents say, must encourage lower speeds and accommodate human error. To that end, Somerville has made hundreds of changes to create what Mr. Rawson calls physical traffic calming. In 2025, Somerville installed more than 70 such upgrades. Of these features, the speed hump has reigned supreme. Since 2019, the city has installed 139 of them. Drivers can comfortably ride over these gradual mounds of raised road at about 15 miles per hour, faster than they can traverse the steeper and taller speed bumps, which slow vehicles to a near halt and tend to be better suited for parking lots than roadways. Speed bumps work. They really work, said Peter Firth, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. Data backs that up. On Laurel Street, a short residential thoroughfare, speeds fell from between 25 to 30 miles an hour to less than 20 miles per hour after speed bumps were added. The number of vehicles hitting pedestrians has dropped citywide for years. Somerville reported 26 such collisions in 2025, compared to 40 in 2013. Fewer cyclists are being hit, too, falling from more than 60 in 2013 to 36 last year. Other traffic calming features included raised side crosswalks, which can lower vehicle speeds and reduce the risk of someone getting hit by 45%, according to the Federal Highway Administration. Curb extensions, where curbs at intersections protrude into the street to shorten crosswalks, have also proven popular in Somerville. Other cities have seen success using similar tools. Hoboken, New Jersey, just over the river from New York City, has gone 9 years without a traffic fatality. To Cedar, the librarian, what sets Somerville apart is its commitment to meeting residents where they are. As chair of the Pedestrian and Transit Advisory Committee, Cedar hosts community walks around areas slated for new infrastructure so that residents can ask questions and make recommendations. What I see Somerville doing differently is recognizing that infrastructure is not going to be successful unless it is really meeting the needs of the community members on the ground, Cedar says. As U.S. small colleges close, towns can struggle. But in Vermont, one turned the page. by Olivia Fletcher, staff writer. Voices bounce off century-old farmhouse walls as actors rehearse for a theater production. Amid the gardens outside, picnic tables fill with attendees of a week-long writing retreat. And across the grounds, students at a therapeutic school rest in the shade of a tree. This scene among the pines and mountains of a small central Vermont town reveals how Plainfield, with a population of nearly 1,000 people, is finding a way to solve a problem vexing communities across the United States. Just 2 years ago, this buzzing commons was an empty college campus. The closures of small colleges across the U.S. affect their town's economic, social, and cultural well-being. In Vermont, one community turned a shuttered campus into a different type of education and destination. Goddard College is one of nearly 2,000 federally funded higher education institutions that have closed over the past 30 years, and one of 17 four-year private nonprofit colleges to shut their doors in 2024 alone. Small private rural colleges are most susceptible to closures due to a combination of declining birth rates and students increasingly choosing the labor market or urban institutions, experts say. These numbers are only expected to grow. The Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education predicts that the number of high school graduates will steadily decline until 2041, reflecting a drop in births after 2007. This will likely lead to fewer traditional college applications and more college closures. The communities these institutions call home often bear the economic, social, and cultural effects of their closures. Plainfield is working to restore what it lost by partnering with a private investor and the state to reinvent Goddard College as a vibrant community hub. The creative campus at Goddard redefines learning as something rooted in collaboration, creativity, and continuous growth, offering one model for other struggling college towns. Just the act of interacting with others on challenging topics does wonders to develop remarkable people, said Robert Kletchen, a professor and head of the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Colleges are often one of the largest employers in rural communities, Dr. Kletchen says. When they close, not only do faculty and staff lose their jobs, but the surrounding economy suffers as local businesses lose customers, which can trigger cascading job losses, prolonged economic depression, and population decline. But college closures don't just leave this economic hole. They leave a cultural hole in the community as well, Dr. Kletchen says. Nathan Grau, a professor of economics at Carleton College in Minnesota, says the students, as well as the campus employees and their families, can strengthen local K-12 schools, for example. The creative campus in Plainfield hopes to reimagine this cultural and intellectual life that Goddard College once brought. After Goddard closed its doors in spring of 2024, Michael Davidson, founder of New Hampshire-based property rental company Ledgeworks, Inc., bought the 131-acre campus for $3.4 million. He worked alongside town members and the select board to understand their aspirations and needs for the space, and has redeveloped it for community use. The partnership now acts as an umbrella lessee, overlooking other nonprofits that rent campus buildings, including youth support organizations, a community radio station, and a sustainable food network. Mr. Davidson and the Creative Campus Board, many of whom are former Goddard faculty members, continue to create a space for people of all ages to live, convene, and learn. In the former Goddard mailroom, where students once collected letters and packages, neighbors now gather for dinner at the new restaurant. The campus rose garden has traded silence for the sounds of weddings and concerts. Colorful buildings that once housed Goddard students are now available to Vermont youth in need. The property's manor house, once a Goddard College library and event space, now serves as a rehearsal space for the Goddard Institute of Dramatic Arts. Barbara Vacker, former Goddard president and now board member of the Creative Campus, and Chris Gruen, director of the Creative Campus and the Hay Barn Theater Arts, says the Creative Campus repurposing works because it breaks down the historic divide between the college and its community. Rather than turning inward during difficult times, the campus meets genuine needs. Favor Ellis, executive director of Elevate Youth Services, a youth well-being and development nonprofit, found kinship through the integrated campus community. Proximity matters, Ms. Ellis says. It tells a young person without anyone having to say it out loud that they belong somewhere ordinary and alive, not somewhere set apart for people who need fixing. As the campus fills with new people and purpose, another idea has taken shape. Education doesn't have to end when a college closes. The Creative Campus team emphasizes lifelong learning, project-based learning, and learning by doing. The hope is that learning happens in living in the community also, Ms. Vacker says, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a course that's being offered, but there's this kind of informal learning that happens when you live in a community. Actors and writers swap stories, for example. Nonprofit staff on campus share advice with other organizations. Ms. Vacker and Mr. Gruen emphasize that while this model of repurposing is working at Goddard, there's no one-size-fits-all solution for towns that lose colleges. They believe successful campus repurposing requires collaboration, a coordinated system of state support and funding, and a private owner who understands regional needs. I think this is a moment where we all have to put our real collaboration and creativity into thinking and let go of our attachment to what has been, and really ask what can be now, Ms. Vacker says. And here's a piece from the Monitor's View. Turkey brightens the outlook for peace. New legislation paves the way to end ethnic conflict and reintegrate Turkey's Kurdish separatists. Even as details are ironed out, the law positions this NATO member to play a stabilizing role in a restive region. By the Monitor's editorial board. In a region that's a flashpoint for unrest, Turkey has taken a key step towards calming domestic as well as cross-border tensions, and it's one that could lead to a new conception of national identity that transcends ethnic and linguistic differences. On Monday, the company's parliament overwhelmingly voted for a landmark bill aimed at conclusively ending more than 40 years of conflict with its substantial Kurdish ethnic minority. The legislation outlines processes for conditional amnesties and the reintegration of thousands of Kurds, including armed combatants who have lived or operated from strongholds in neighboring Iran, Iraq, and Syria for decades. An estimated 31 million Kurds are spread across all four countries, and various factions have fought for independence or greater autonomy. Turkey's separatist Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, designated a terrorist organization by Turkey, the United States, and the European Union, abandoned the goal of full independence a few decades ago. And in May 2025, it announced it would disband and disarm, thus putting the onus on the Turkish government to move the process along. Many Kurds cautiously welcome the move as a chance to pivot towards democratic struggle. Garo Paylan, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, said at the time, but he noted they would want to see concrete commitments on political representation, cultural rights, and the reintegration of Kurdish voices into public life. Last week, long-imprisoned PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan described the pending legislation as the beginning of a democratization process that will be at least as significant as the founding of the republic, which was established in 1920 after the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. This phase of reconciliation positions Turkey, a key and well-armed member of NATO, to exert a constructive and stabilizing influence in the region. Ankara had been at loggerheads with Syria for several years, believing it was aiding large numbers of PKK fighters. It also regularly conducted military raids and held territory in Iraq's Kurdistan region. But last year, within 3 months of the PKK announcement, Turkish attacks on Iraqi territory fell by 97%, according to an international rights organization. Now, Turkey is helping Iraq and other oil-producing Gulf states export and import goods across Turkish roadways, while the Strait of Hormuz remains blocked. Similarly, it could also support Syria's recovery from civil war. The key challenge is at home, as well as in the EU, which Turkey has long sought to join, as Turkish citizens await tangible evidence of a more inclusive and responsive political system. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been consolidating power and silencing dissent in recent years. Several opposition skeptics view his gestures of peace towards Kurds as little more than a political ploy to gain popularity and extend his term in office. But Zakir Avsar, a professor at Ankara's Hacı Bayram Veli University, urges a more magnanimous view of developments. What's important, he told the local daily Sabah newspaper on Tuesday, is attaining a balance among security and freedom, public order and democratic politics, and citizens' sense of belonging. The success of this process, in Mr. Avsar's words, should be measured not by the political advantage it provides to one side over another, but by its contribution to Turkey's common future. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.